So the homework one, make sure that you submit it before you leave today. And who knows what this painting is? I mean, right before this class is a class which talks about soul. I don't know whether you guys are, you should come a little early to listen to this other person who is talking about soul and indivisibility of soul and so on. Beautiful stuff. This is Guernica by Pablo Picasso. It just so happens that it's a kind of a, considered a powerful statement about generally killing of innocence. You can go up and read more about that later on. These are the project statistics, project zero statistics. Basically, as I said, it's mostly for warm-up, but apparently the averages are pretty high. The TA did separate undergraduate and graduate means. And I thought this is a useful piece of information in case you need extra help. Apparently, there is this company which does outsourcing of homework. And what I really liked is for $9.95 per page, they can give you completely non-plagiarized. So it took me a while to figure out what that meant until I realized it's like completely vegetarian beef, where the cow is vegetarian and you are not. But we actually are happy to beat their prices, I and the TA and the tutor. So, you know, for like $8, we might give you a better deal. So if you're anyway paying, you know, ask us. Okay. Any questions before we go on with the discussion? We seem to have a lot of chairs today. None. Okay. How are things with project one? Obviously very good. Okay. So I am going to discuss local search algorithms that we started talking about last class, complete that discussion and go on to planning, which is, you can think of pretty much everything in this course as a straightforward application of search at some level or other. But I thought we'll start with planning because it's sort of, it's very easy to see where the search is and how you would be deriving heuristics. So that's the deal that we're going to be doing today. Last time we talked about this idea of min conflict based hill climbing search. So that if you're doing, let's say, something like the n queens problem, which the idea is to place n queens on an n by n chessboard such that no pair of them are conflicting. Okay, it's an assignment problem. And the question, of course, is how do you get those configurations? And then we talked about the possibility that we could actually do hill climbing search on this, where the neighborhood, for a hill climbing search, the most important things are neighborhood, goodness function. Those are the two things. Okay? So you have to define the neighborhood for a node, and the bigger your neighborhood, the much more, so it's no longer local. The bigger your neighborhood, you're no longer local search. So in the extreme case, if your neighborhood is the entire search space that's connected to you, okay, then hill climbing is not really local anymore, it's global. And so it won't have most of the problems you think hill climbing will have. But then, of course, that would also make hill climbing be extremely inefficient, because if you generate your entire search space as the neighborhood of a node, and then you're trying to figure out which is the best node among all of those, it'll take a whole bunch of time before you actually pick the best seat. Okay? So in this case, in this example, what are we doing for neighborhood? So for the goodness function, for this example, the goodness function is just the number of conflicts. number of pairwise conflicts that are left. Okay, and it will become zero at the goal node, and anywhere else it's a non-zero number, non-zero positive number. Okay, so in this case, hill climbing is trying to drive down the value of the number of conflicts. Okay, so if I give you something like this as the configuration, current configuration of the board, the question, of course, is how do I define the neighborhood? Okay, for now, forget about the numbers in those cells. These are all the queens. And just so that we're all on the same page, you all know how two queens conflict, right? That means they're either in the same diagonal or in the same row or in the same column. That's it. Okay, so it turns out, and you can do this number, this is basically from the text, this particular configuration of these queens has 17 conflicts currently left. Okay, so if you count all the pairwise conflicts, there are 17 conflicts there between these queens. So obviously it's not a goal. Okay, so the question is, how am I going to generate neighborhood nodes around this and then figure out for each of them how many conflicts are there and pick the one with the lowest number of conflicts? That's the idea. Now you'll notice that you'll always try to generate small neighborhoods. If you generate too big a neighborhood, as I said, you will be global, but then you will take huge amount of time per node. So per expansion, you will take a huge amount of time. Okay. So notice that, so the way I'll do here, the standard way that's done is you will assume that each queen is constrained to its column, first of all. That's without loss of generality, because you know that ultimately every solution would have each queen in a different column. That's not even an assumption. That's just without loss of generality. Okay. So then the question really is, how do I shift this queen? So this queen can be shifted around in its column. This can be shifted. This can be shifted. So the two questions are, one, how many queens am I going to shift to generate my neighborhood? Okay. And two, how am I going to shift it? Now, the first question, if I consider shifting all queens in their respective columns, then I'm in essence looking at the entire search space. You have to understand that. Okay? So if I don't want to do that, so if this is 8 queens, so suppose I consider shifting 7 queens, that's more local, less global than shifting 8 queens. Okay? Shifting 6 queens is more local than 7. And shifting one queen is the most local. Okay? So I would just consider shifting one queen. Okay? Obviously, the more local the search is, the more likely it's going to get stuck in local minima, etc. Okay, that's understood. But the more local the search is, hopefully the faster per iteration cost is, and you know, so the performance of the search in terms of iteration cost is much lower. Okay, so we'll consider shifting one of the queens and changing their position. And now these numbers show up. If you keep everybody else in their position, this is the set race variable. If you keep everybody else the way they are and just shift this guy around, and you can count that if you shift him or her queen from here to here, it will become 15 conflicts. Now, you know, it's painful for you to count, but you can write a little program which will count this. Not that hard. Okay, if you shift it here, it will be 14. If you shift it here, it will be 14. Here, it will become 18, 18, 14. So if you just are shifting this guy and leaving everybody else in their position, those are the best you can get. Those are the constants you can get. Similarly, if you shift this guy around, keeping everybody else around constant, then you can get these. And you notice that here, this is a 12. That's pretty low compared to the best you can ever get by shifting this queen around while keeping everybody else constant is 14, whereas the best you can get by shifting this guy is 12. Okay, whatever I'm showing, you can write a program for it. It's, you know, what is kind of painful for us is quite easy for computer. You know, it's just, you know, computing all the possibilities and, you know, counting all the conflicts. Okay, and so on for each of the queens. So now I can just say that pick the queen, I mean, so pick the move So each of these are the possible moves. I could pick this queen to any of these positions, or this queen to any of these positions, this are to any of these positions. And those are all the moves that I have. Okay? So that would essentially be what? 7 times 7 times. So there are 7 moves here, 7 moves here, 7 moves here, and so on. Those are all the moves I have. I don't multiply those because I'm not considering them together. I'm only considering one queen at a time. So I really have 8 times 7 moves here. Okay? Of those 8 times 7 moves, the best moves correspond to these 12 because the lowest you can ever get is 12. So you pick one of those. Really, you know, all of them are equally good. So you'll pick one of them and then you shift the queen, you know, let's say if you like this row, then you shift this queen here. And that will give you the new position. And when you get to the new position, you'll forget about your old position. You completely forget about where you've been. Hill climbing is permanently amnesiac. Okay, it only remembers the current node. Which actually also makes hill climbing a pretty much a beautiful algorithm for doing online search. You know, it's a word that I haven't used, it's a phrase that I haven't used, but all search algorithms till now essentially are thinking that you would search for the best solution, find the path, and having found the path, then you give it to the agent, which will then start executing it. Okay, but if you're doing hill climbing, in fact, you can actually, after figuring out the best move, you can make the move and then start the search all over again there. Okay, and in fact, going up the Everest just by using altimeter is executing, you know, you're executing on, you know, at the time. Okay, so in case of hill climbing algorithms, actually you could either do them offline or online. You know, both of them are possible. Okay, so that's the deal. You understand now how this thing works? So per the only thing that you have to remember is the number of conflicts and what the neighborhood is. Okay, now I'll tell you a variation of this. And you tell me whether it's more local or less local. Okay, I will randomly pick a queen. Just toss an 8-sided coin and pick a queen. Okay, and find the best position that queen can be put to. So now how many neighbors do I consider per iteration? 7. Right? So is it more or less local? More local. So it's likely to get, you know, stuck more than the one that we just saw. But that's possible too. In fact, it turns out that that approach also works reasonably well. Okay, so you could toss a coin and pick a queen and then find what's the best position for it. Here, you consider all the queens, all their best positions, and pick one of them. Okay? Now, in the context of this, so if I go, so what happens in hill climbing? We said that in hill climbing, sometimes, so here is the important thing before you even went there. Remember that in hill climbing, the important thing is you want to make sure that the goodness function has to improve when you make the move. Otherwise, there's no point in making the move. Okay, if it's not going to improve, then you say, I have gotten as far as I could get. That's the best place. So I'm just going to state that this is the best you can get to. Now, in this case, it did, right? Because h equal to 17, so the number of conflicts in this configuration was 17. Okay, and then the best neighbor you chose wound up having 12 conflicts. So it did improve. Okay, so you would make this move. Now, consider this problem, where, in essence, it's a scenario where there is a single conflict. There's only a single conflict. And what's the conflict, by the way? There. That's the conflict. Just one conflict. Very close. But if you consider the usual way of defining the neighborhood, that is 56 other neighbors, which involves shifting any one of the single queens, the number of conflicts will increase. They will no longer stay at one. They will become 2 or 5 or 15 or something. So it's a scenario where you feel that this is not a goal state because the number of conflicts is not zero. And yet all your neighbors are worse than you are. the way I define the neighborhood. So what do I do? At that point, hill climbing says, time for another restart. So what would you do? You just randomly shuffle the board again and start all over again. And probabilistically speaking, you might not get stuck. I mean, at least the chance that you would get stuck in the exact same local minimum is quite low. And so, you know, hopefully you might get to a goal. Now notice here, you have to understand why this is a local minimum. It's a local minimum only with respect to the neighborhood I have defined. It's a local minimum only with respect to the neighborhood I have defined. In the sense, if I'm only considering moving one queen at a time, which means I have 56 neighbors, all those 56 neighbors are worse than me. But if I define the neighborhood larger, you know, in the worst case, I mean, in the most ambitious case, if I define my neighborhood to be all 8 queens can be shifted around, then clearly there's a goal. I mean, if in fact this problem is solvable, there is a goal node in my neighborhood. Okay, so the idea of local minimum is very directly connected to how much of a neighborhood you are looking around. And you know, this is not, you know, from the Everest analogy, if you have bad eyesight and there is a, you know, big snowstorm, then you really cannot see much more than right around you. And so you can only actually make the step and take the altimeter reading. If it's a darn clear day and you can see a huge peak looming in front of you, but you still say, okay, here I'm going down, here I'm going down, here I'm going down, all four sides I'm going down, I won't go anywhere. That makes no sense because you actually have a much bigger neighborhood you can see. Okay? So local minima are with respect to neighborhoods that are defined, and as I said, you want to define neighborhoods to be not too small, not too large. You know, if it's too large, then you can get stuck in the per iteration cost. So with respect to this problem, if you are talking about, remember we talked about making hill climbing asymptotically complete. To make it asymptotically complete, you could do one of these three things we discussed. One is random restart, which in essence, in that previous case, when we got stuck, you just randomly reshuffle and start all over again. That's one idea. Okay. The other is bias random walk. Now, what would bias random walk mean in our previous case? What it would mean is, having looked at the entire neighborhood here, you decided what are the best neighbors. All these 12 are your best neighbors. With probability p, you take one of the best neighbors. And with probability 1 minus p, you take any of the other neighbors. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you are not always going greedily in the direction of most improvement. Okay? And if this probability p is high, that basically means you, most of the time you're doing the greedy thing, but every once in a while to hedge your bets, you're doing the non-greedy thing. That's what it means in this particular problem. Okay? And in fact, the work done has shown, I mean, the general empirical results show that this winds up being better than this. Because in a way, this avoids being greedy to begin with, whereas this one will be greedy, go get stuck, and restart all over again. It's not obvious which would be better, but for n queens problems, this has been shown to be kind of better. Okay, the other version of this, you know, which we talked about at the very end of the class, is simulated annealing. And all that does is, rather than start with a constant p and stick to it for the entire search, it starts with a p which changes during the search. So in the beginning of the search, the probability p is set to be lower, so that in the beginning you are not all the time greedy. But as the amount of time you spent has increased, right, then you reduce, so you increase the probability of being greedy. And that's simulated annealing. Now the schedule with which you increase it, you know, can be different. And in fact, there are specific kinds of increases which if you do, then you would get the badge simulated annealing. But the important intuition is, the probability starts low, probability of being greedy starts low and increases as the search goes on. Now, in both these cases, you could still do this and still go get stuck in a local minimum, in which case you do randomly. You can always do this. okay? And that's how you will get asymptotically complete, okay? So that sort of should give you a sort of a feel for how hill climbing works, how min conflict algorithm works. This idea for this general idea where the goodness function is defined in terms of conflicts, okay, are the violations of constraints. You know, there are constraints on a chessboard saying in this particular case two queens cannot be in such positions, certain positions, because otherwise there will be conflict. And if you count the number of constraints that are violated, and you keep reducing the number of constraints violated, those are called min conflict algorithms. You're minimizing conflict. And you're greedily minimizing with some component of less greediness thrown in. Okay, and the other component is thrown in only to guarantee asymptotic convergence. Okay, because you are not looking at the entire neighborhood, you're looking at small neighborhood. Okay. Having understood it this way, as I said, these guys, with these, you can solve really large problems. As I said, million queens problems can be solved in under minutes, which is pretty darn impressive. Okay. And what's interesting is, if you think of solving queens problem as equivalent to solving problems where the number of constraints being violated has to be driven down, that's a much more general problem. And when we get to, for example, logical inference or even probabilistic inference, we'll see that something that we might want to do is find assignments which are satisfying. That means none of the clauses are violated. And again, I'm jumping ahead, but I know that all of you know something about Boolean algebra. Okay, so if I give you a huge number of Boolean clauses, and I'm asking you, give me a satisfying assignment. That means give me truth, falsity values for all the variables such that all these clauses are satisfied. That's sort of like n queens puzzle, where the clauses are the constraints. And for every assignment, so if I have 100 variables, p1 to p100, okay, then each of them can have truth and falsity. That means there are 2 power 100 possible assignments. You pick a random one and see how many clauses are violated. The number of clauses violated is the number of conflicts. Now the question is, if it's not zero, then you want to improve it. The question is, what can you do in Boolean variables? You can flip them. If it's true, you make it false. If it's false, you make it true. The only other question is, how many guys are you going to flip together? Just like in Queen's problem, we can say, I will flip one proposition at a time. One proposition at a time. Okay? And so you're talking about 100 propositions, and you consider what would happen if I flip any one of these propositions. And I'll compute the number of conflicts for each of those, and then pick the assignment that will be the least conflict. That's very much like the 8-queen problem. We'll look at this again. And it turns out that this problem has huge number of applications. It's across the board. It's there in AI, but it's also there in, if you have a large circuit, a Boolean circuit, and you're trying to figure out whether it'll get into some bad configurations or not, you would wind up solving these kinds of problems. And the current scenario is how many clauses and how many variables can you handle? And we currently can handle up to millions of clauses and millions of variables. Clearly it's not a homework problem, it's definitely not an exam problem. But you can do this. The local search actually works quite well in this problem. Okay. So let's look at a couple of variations of hill climbing. Now that you understand the idea of neighborhood and goodness search, goodness function, I did not actually talk about how do you make the goodness function for a problem. It's sort of like making a heuristic for a problem. Okay, in the 8-queens problem, the number of conflicts was a good measure, and it should have the if it has the property that it becomes zero for like the goals and non-zero everywhere else, let's say. Then you could actually just, in essence, you're minimizing it, okay, on this goodness function. Now, consider the following scenario, a variation of hill climbing, where rather than in hill climbing, I'm considering one seed state at each point of time. Okay, remember in the picture that I showed, I had one particular board configuration. I considered all its neighbors, picked the best neighbor, and that becomes my seed now. Okay, and again do the same thing for it, and then pick the best neighbor. That becomes my seed now again. Okay, another idea would be, why should I have just one seed? Why not have k seeds? K is greater than or equal to 1. Okay, so I will start with 4 board configurations up front, and then consider all their neighborhoods, pick the neighborhood which is, and then pick based on these 4 configurations, I pick 4 best neighbors. Those will become the seeds for the next iteration. And again, take all their neighbors and pick the 4 best across, and they will become the 4 best for the next iteration. So this would be sort of doing a beam search. Instead of doing one seed, you're doing 4 guys sort of parallel. At each time, you're looking at the best 4. Now, the way I described it, actually, it's not required that every seed will give the next, in the next iteration, every seed will have 1 neighbor in the next iteration. That's not needed. If that's the case, then that's like actually solving 4 hill climbing problems in parallel, 4 copies of the same program in parallel, running them in parallel. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I want to differentiate between running 4 copies of the same hill climbing program and same hill climbing program in 4 machines and seeing whichever run, you know, gets done first, versus running 1 copy of the hill climbing program on your machine where you are looking at 4 seeds at every level, 4 best seeds. What's my 4 best ideas right now? Okay, and it may well be that by the time you go to the second level, of the 4, only 1 comes from this guy, none comes from this guy, none comes from this guy, and 3 comes from this guy. Okay, this is called beam search. You know, beam search based hill climbing. Now, if you consider beam search based hill climbing, this is not hard to understand. Then stochastic beam search hill climbing is almost close to the way evolution seems to work. Okay, except with one difference, which is that the neighborhood itself is defined in terms of the k seeds that you have kept with you. Okay, so again, this for those people who at least remember something about evolution and how cell division occurs, you know that in essence, when the new births occur, you wind up having a cell from 2 individuals come and cross. So basically, you take piece from one, piece from other, splice them, and then do some random mutation. That's what you find. That's what evolution does. Right? That's what the cell division. That's what the neighborhood is defined here in the context of the neighbors in the context of the seeds themselves. So the one difference between my analogy in 8 queens and here is in 8 queens analogy, I would still be looking at the neighborhood for each of the seeds separately, taking 4 times 56 neighbors, taking the 4 best neighbors among these 4 times 56 neighbors. Whereas in this version, these 4 seeds sort of interbreed and give rise to a neighborhood among which you compute the best neighbor. If you do this, then you would be doing something sort of like what evolution is doing, and so you call them genetic algorithms. And a bunch of people have written in what might you want to learn in this course, they say, oh, genetic algorithms, they look cool. This is genetic algorithms. Genetic algorithms really is hill climbing, stochastic, so the beam search based hill climbing, that means you have K seeds, and the neighborhood is defined in terms of the seeds themselves. Okay, that's your hill climbing. So to give an idea, so if I have, let's say, some 4 seeds here, then in essence, I would define the next level seeds in terms of intermingling of these seeds. And whether or not somebody would actually take part in the breeding depends on how good they are to begin with. Okay, the survival of the fittest individuals get to breed more often, and the guys who are not stand in the corner. So they don't have representatives in the next generation. Okay, so it's the entire analogy you can push. So in this case, this guy has 24 goodness, he has 23 goodness, he has 20 goodness, he has 11 goodness. And so you can see the percentages that they will breed. They will take part in a mating. Okay? And when they do mate, in essence, you take a piece from here and a piece from here. So if these two guys are mating here, you take a piece from here and a piece from here and generate the next neighbor, the child node from this breeding. Okay? And then you do random mutation. This is exact, you know, copying that we're doing of what happens. What happens when the, I'm sorry, I'm blanking out on the technical terms, when the, what, some things meet during intercourse and new babies are born, okay? So this is essentially your exact same analogy for hill climbing algorithm, okay? So now, of course, the question is, hey, you know, it seems to have worked for, you know, evolution. So in some states, they won't use genetic algorithms because we are against evolution there, but others can. Now, just because we are in a state where we don't disbelieve in evolution doesn't necessarily mean that we must use genetic algorithms. They could still be a pretty losing idea. Okay. To the extent evolution has a goal, and I'm sure all of us think that we are the goal. You know, the evolution, essentially, the goal of evolution is to produce us so that we can listen to this boring lecture. The interesting thing is evolution took forever to get to us. You know, it's pretty darn inefficient. If it was any good, we should have been here way back then, right? So, in essence, there is no real reason to believe that just because it's done in evolution this way, a program, a search algorithm, should actually behave this way. And furthermore, to make this work, you should make sure that a piece from here, when combined together, will still make something which has the same general properties as the original seed. Here's my idea to make the world's best program. I take two best programs from both, you know, one guy from here, one guy from here, take the first 79 characters from this, next 84 characters from this, splice them along. And then also do some random noise and see if it works. This would be like monkeys trying to make Shakespeare by just randomly hitting on the you know, typewriter. It, asymptotically, it would happen. But you don't necessarily have the time to hang around for that. You know. So as you can see, the, it's nice to understand genetic search algorithms in terms of hill climbing. But whether or not genetic search is the good motive for a particular problem depends very much on whether you have a goodness function which can be defined in terms of taking pieces from, you know, from seeds and combining them and still making sense. Okay? The smartest idea that basically the nature did in terms of this evolution that happened was you take half the chromosomes from one guy, half the chromosomes from one girl, and you splash them together, it seems to work most of the time. It's not like taking 79 characters from this guy's program and 79 from this guy's program. That doesn't seem to work. So until we find out the version in terms of chromosomes for programs, you haven't gotten a chance of at least being as efficient as evolution, which to begin with is inefficient. If you consider the goal of evolution to be to produce us. Okay. But of course, Darwin is now turning in the grave. Evolution has no goal. Okay, evolution essentially was to produce fittest and, you know, hopefully make sure that this way you are, it's an online search, first of all. And there was no goal. It just so happened that somewhere along the line we showed up. Okay. It could be depending on who you ask, it's a mistake by evolution, or, you know, it's a good thing. But if we are the goal, then it took forever. Okay, that's genetic search. Are there any questions on genetic search? So the big issue is very careful modeling is needed so that things emerging from crossover and mutation are still potential seeds. You can't take 79 characters and hope that it's a program. you have to find pieces at which you can take piece from here, and the new piece, the sewn-up new piece, still is a program. Okay? If you can do that, and in fact, all the genetic algorithms people wind up finding such things for their problem. Now, if you do that, then, you know, it would work. Except it's not very clear whether the genetic metaphor really is buying you anything, or whether you could have just thought of it as KRE beam search in hill climbing. Okay. However, there is a huge community called genetic algorithms who would believe that this is the right way to do it. I don't like them. At the same time, I don't like the people who think that evolution shouldn't be taught in the school. Okay, it's completely different. I mean, I am not inconsistent. It's just because evolution is a theory doesn't mean that you should do, I mean, is a well-established theory doesn't mean that you should write computer programs that also follow that. Okay? It's interesting. It's a nice metaphor. But that's about it. Another thing is continuous spaces, hill climbing search in continuous spaces. In fact, in continuous spaces, you really cannot do systematic search oftentimes, because the branching factor, unless you define branching factor in terms of intervals, branching factor itself is too large. Okay, so in continuous spaces often, the reason I brought this up, despite the fact that we have never talked about continuous search in this class, is because we will use this kind of algorithms later on during machine learning and so on. Essentially, in continuous spaces, finding a minimum of a function, an arbitrary function, is like, you can do that by doing hill climbing. Okay? Why is that? So if you have this function, and you know that whenever there's a minimum, the gradient will be zero. Right? So the question is, how do you get to the point where the gradient is zero? Not all gradient equal to zeros correspond to global minimums, but a minimum will have gradient equal to zero. Okay, so some of them may be local minimum, some of them may be global minimum. So the usual thing that we do is wherever you start from any random point in this function, take the gradient at that point, which is the derivative. Okay, now for this particular function, the derivative here essentially shows that you're going up. So, and the slope with which you're going up. Because as x is increasing, the function value is increasing. Now you take a step in the opposite direction to the gradient. If you're going up, that means you left the minimum already. So come down. Okay, you take a step opposite to the direction of the gradient. Now how big a step should you take? I don't know. Alpha times the gradient, where alpha is the fudge factor that we'll play with. Okay, so all you would do is start from, let's say, to find this point on the function, you start from any random point, x0, take the gradient, take the new x0 to be, new x1, so the new estimate of x0, which is x1, to be x0 minus the derivative of the function at this point times alpha. The minus sign is to take a step in the opposite direction. If this was a multidimensional function, then you would take a partial derivative, and the partial derivative would be a vector in that multidimensional space. You take a step in the direction opposite to that vector. Okay? And then how big a step? Alpha tells you how big a step. And you play with, if you take big alphas, if you take big steps, then what's likely to happen is you would, when you'll be here, you'll make such a big jump that you'll come here. And then you make another big jump, you'll come here and jump like this. Okay? If you take a small alpha, you'll just sort of creep your way here. So you need somewhere in between. There's a huge amount of literature as to how to set this alpha, and for example, things like be aggressive in the beginning and start reducing the alpha as you come closer. Already you notice that the step that you are taking will become smaller for a given alpha, for any given alpha. That's a point one. The step you take will be smaller around here than here, because the step is alpha times the gradient. Gradient is already small around here, and it's bigger here. Okay? So it is something that you guys knew already, and you did this, right, in the Project Zero? You found the Newton-Raphson method for finding cube roots. That's exactly what you did. And you know how well it works. Okay. What's interesting, of course, is if you have a multidimensional space, then you would have a vector, and then you take a direction, you know, a step in the opposite direction of the vector, and then the whole issue in this area would be how to set the alpha correction. Now, there is no such thing as correct, but how to set the alpha such that you wouldn't do major oscillations. Okay? So that's continuous hill climbing. And what is the neighborhood here? So we need to talk about goodness function and neighborhood. Neighborhood is essentially defined implicitly by the derivative times an alpha. Okay, and you're also defining the direction. So in fact, you're kind of looking around this, and you obviously go in the opposite direction to the derivative. It tells you how to improve your goodness. Question? Okay. So one more thing is we talked about hill climbing, which is local search, which has no memory, and it has a huge amount of freedom. It can go anywhere. You know, if that place looks good, we'll go there from here. As long as it's in my neighborhood, I'll get there. Okay. And we also talked about systematic search, where you actually follow rules to make sure that, you know, if there is a node which is kind of nice, but it's in the other branch, you to get there, you may have to go all the way up and come down if you're doing, let's say, depth first search. So there is a search tree poses certain amount of constraints on your mobility in the search space. Hill climbing, on the other hand, is happily following the gradients of the search space. If you set up your goodness function such that the goodness function naturally follows the gradient of the search space. Okay, so for example, hill climbing is what is used when designing sinks. Because you make sure that in every place in the sink, you know, the gradient is pushing the water towards the hole in the sink. Except there was a place where I lived for a long time where it was exactly the opposite. So all the water will come here, and then we'll take a huge broomstick and push it back. You know, so that guy didn't know. He did some of the idea, but he didn't set the gradient correctly. But in essence, you set the gradient correctly, making local decisions in the order, in the direction of the greedy movement will get you to the global minimum. Okay. In fact, one very effective approach for solving find path problems, which is if there is a bunch of obstacles and a robot has to go from one place to some other place in this room, is to actually make all these obstacles together, you know, use all these obstacles to set up a potential function, which is a virtual height function, okay, such that this potential function essentially has a global minimum right there and has no local minimums anywhere. If you can design that, if you set that potential function right, then just following local gradients of this potential field will get the robot to its goal just the way following local gradients of my sink floor will get the water to the sink hole. Okay? Now, so hill climbing can just follow the gradients, whereas systematic search has to sort of make sure that it's following the constraints imposed by the search tree. But on the other hand, systematic search does have some advantages. If there is no solution, systematic search will tell you that there is no solution. Especially if you have a finite search space, it can exhaust the space and say there is no solution to this problem. Hill climbing, on the other hand, they just keep restarting, and then after a while you say, you know, it's been 2 days, I'll stop now. Okay? And furthermore, if the space is densely connected, hill climbing can very well get into cycles because it doesn't remember where it's been, so it can go in cycles. Okay? So, the question is, can we get these two together and make algorithms which have the advantages of both? Can we make something which has some of the advantages of hill climbing and some of the advantages of systematic search? Why would you do that? A, because in fact such algorithms do well in practice, and B, because it plays with your, you know, it's like messes with your mind. You know, you're thinking, you thought of these two as completely different things, but it turns out you can put them together. Okay. So, for example, you can reduce the freedom of hill climbing search to make it more complete. And the way you could do it is make it remember some of the places it's been, so that if it again tries to get this, it'll stop. It won't ever get to the places it's been. So you define taboos, and you say this is a taboo node, this is a taboo node, this is a taboo node. And the taboo search is you find the best neighbor, but if the neighbor is in the taboo list, then ignore it, even though it's the best one, and pick some other name. And if you make taboo list to be as big as the search space, hill climbing would never get stuck in cycle, ever. Right? So that's one way. But normally, in fact, it turns out that even for like a small taboo list, hill climbing significantly improves performance. Okay, that's called taboo search. So there, you're taking some of the ideas of systematic search and applying it to hill climbing. The other idea is sort of more interesting. You let the systematic search, so this is the taboo search, you can read this, I just mentioned that to you. In an idea called random restart systematic search. It's not random restart hill climbing, it's called random restart systematic search. And it does the following thing. It essentially, in a search tree, let's say, what it does is it starts, anytime it expands nodes, okay, it randomly permutes the nodes. For now, just, assume simple depth first search. It randomly permutes the nodes before it puts them on the queue, which means it's not always going to take the leftmost node. Sometimes it takes the middle node, sometimes it takes the end node, sometimes it takes the leftmost node. Every time it randomly permutes its children nodes. That's the only change you make for the children generation in your depth first search. The other thing you will do is you will keep something called a patience factor, which is the number of nodes that if you have expanded those many nodes, then you want to try something else. Okay? And if you have expanded, let's say, 1,000 nodes, every time you expanded 1,000 nodes and you're not yet done, it's probably because you made a fatal error in the very beginning of the search tree. And in systematic search, if all the solutions are on this branch and you made a fatal mistake of going this side in the beginning, then you are dead. By the time you'll come here in a depth first search, you have to exhaust this entire space before you can come here. Right? Because that's the only way you can come here. And so what you would do is, 1,000 nodes and I haven't yet seen a goal node. Let me restart the search. So go back to the root node, do the same exact thing that I did previously. Now, since I'm always randomly permuting my nodes, the second time I do the same thing, I'm actually doing a different thing. So the second time I go down the same tree, I won't come to this part. Maybe I'll come to this part. Okay? This works wonders. And homework is done. Does this ring you any bell? You did a version of this problem in the homework. It didn't call itself random restart search, but the idea of iterative broadening, where you start iteratively seeing more and more children of the same node, the motivation for that is actually the same as the motivation for random restart search. Okay? In essence, it reduces the probability that you make a fatal mistake in the very beginning. Okay, so the iterative broadening search is quite interesting compared to iterative deepening search. It winds up seeing, so if the iterative deepening search looks at this part of the tree first, then this part, and so on, iterative broadening sort of looks at every guy's first leftmost child would be looked at first. Then every guy's leftmost and the next child would be looked at second, and so on. So the tree that you're looking at actually starts looking very funny. But the reason you're doing it, and the only reason it makes sense, is because if you don't have enough of a good guidance to decide which direction to go, and if you made a mistake in the beginning, then normal depth first search will just kill you. you know, by the time you get back to the right node, right branch, you can do a huge number of backtracks. Whereas iterative broadening search can be better. Now, in fact, random restart search is even better than iterative broadening search because essentially you just have a patience factor and you keep modifying, you do the only one change to the depth first search, which is when you put the children onto the queue, just randomly permute them so that you are not always going to the leftmost child first. It actually works wonders for certain types of problems. And again, the best way to think of it is it's increasing the freedom of movement of a systematic search. Rather than saying, I'll first look at the left-hand corner, then the right-hand corner, then this corner, then this corner, it actually kind of lets you look at the entire space at some resolution first. Then again, the entire space at a slightly better resolution, which is sort of making you look more and more like the freedom that's enjoyed by hill climbing, but without the cost that the hill climbing pays, which is lack of completeness. Yes, sir. Random permutation essentially is so you randomly permute. So I have a node N1 and I call the children generator function. It gives me N2, N3, N4, N5. Okay, that's a list. A random permutation of that is one of the 4 factorial permutation for that. So you just randomly generate it. That's all. That's a random permutation. Okay. Notice that adding that randomness is critical. If you don't do that, when you redo the whole thing, you will again go through the exact same mistake. So there's no point in restarting. Unless you have the random permutation, there's no point in restarting at all. Okay? So we're going to leave search and go into planning, which is again a different kind of search. So we looked at systematic search and we looked at blind systematic search, which is breadth first, depth first, uniform cost search, iterative deepening depth first search. We looked at informed searches, which are A star, IDA star, SMA star, etc. And we looked at local search, which is hill climbing and variations of making hill climbing complete. And we looked at things like multi-seed hill climbing. And then we looked at this other bullet, which is combining hill climbing and systematic search strategies together. Okay? Which is possible. And the main important point you want to understand there is you get more freedom with hill climbing, but fewer guarantees. Way few guarantees about completeness. With systematic search, you get guarantees, but you're constrained. One thing I should mention is I kind of talked a lot about depth first search, and I made it look as if depth first search and breadth first search are only for losers. But suppose I have a problem where all the goal nodes are at the final level. It's a finite tree of depth D. And all the goal nodes are at the bottom. Does it make sense to do iterative deepening depth first search on this? If you ever try to do iterative deepening depth first search on a tree where all the children, where it is a finite tree, it's a finite space and all the solutions are in the very final level, hit yourself really hard in the back of your head and wake up, because you're wasting your entire life when you're searching this part. I told you already, the only solutions that are there are here. So what would you use instead? Depth-first search. In fact, there is a whole class of problems called combinatorial problems, where the search space is finite. 8 queens is a classic case of combinatorial problem. Okay, think of the problem of 8 queens as 8 variables which require assignments between 1 to 8. And when such that their complete assignment should not have any conflict. So if you start the search tree, if you write the search tree here, starting with assignment for the first queen here, second queen here, third queen here, by the way, all the eight queens here, then you know that the only solutions to the eight queen problem would have to be in the very final level. Furthermore, you know that that tree is only going to be eight deep. A million queen problem will have a tree which is only a million deep. So you should do breadth first search. I mean, you should do depth first search. And if you do random restart depth first search on eight queen problems, you can give a run for the money for your friend who is using min conflict based hill climbing search. Okay, so that's a problem where you can do either of them, and it turns out random restart can do quite well. Okay, I want you to understand that there are problems where search tree isn't always going to infinitely deep places. If it's a finite search tree and all the solutions are at the same depth, then you would use informed depth first search method. Okay? A depth informed or blind depth first search.
Okay.
Change of topic. So what we'll do is a slightly different kind of problem where, so until now the only thing we agreed upon is in a search tree, you would have a node, and you have a children generator function, you have a goal test function. Okay, all the stuff that you know about the domain and the problem are opaquely rendered in these two pieces of code, children generator and goal test. Okay, it's amazing how far we can get without knowing what it is that we are trying to solve. Okay, children generator and goal test are the ones that know everything about the problem. And all the search algorithms are doing is essentially looking at some numbers and trying to go one direction versus another direction. It's very interesting that even at that level of abstraction, there are so many issues that we can talk about, such as how much space is consumed, can you guarantee optimality, etc., etc. Now my question is, can I go a step down and say, if I consider problems where I know something about the internal structure of the search nodes, would I be able to do better? Would I be able to do better? So planning, from the point of view of this discussion, think of planning as a scenario where the search states are no longer black boxes. They have structure. States essentially will wind up getting defined in terms of features that we call state variables. So each state of the problem is defined by giving, so you start with some number of state variables, let's say v1 to v8. These can be continuous variables, these could be multi-valued variables, that means they can have, you know, some number of discrete values. They can be Boolean, that means they can be true or false. For the simplest case that we will stick to, we'll assume that these state variables are Boolean. So they can be true or false. So if I have eight variables, how many possible states can I represent? 2^8. Okay? So if I have eight state variables, I can represent 2^8 states, and then actions will essentially still be taking you from one state to another state. If it's a deterministic domain, an action will take you from a given state to another determined state. If it's a non-deterministic domain, when you apply an action to a state, you can get possibly multiple states. What that means is during the actual execution, one of these states will happen. So for example, during search, if I want to apply, suppose I have a coin, okay? So, and I can represent the coin toss world in terms of one single state variable called heads. It's either true or false. Okay? And there are how many states in this world? Two states. Heads, tails. That's it. Those are only two states. Okay? And there is one action, toss. And toss takes heads and gives you either heads or tails. So that's a non-deterministic action. You go from one state to multiple states. And if it's a biased coin, where it's more likely to come heads than tails, then I can say, well, I can go from heads and bias toss will get me to heads with 0.7 probability, tails with 0.3 probability. That time there is not heads, not negation. Okay? Heads with 0.7 probability, not heads with 0.3 probability. So I can do all this discussion about search algorithms in the context of this extra assumption that all states can be represented in terms of state variables. And you can think of planning essentially as doing whatever we did till now, which is basically search, except in the context of states which are representable in terms of state variables. And actions, now the question of course is how are actions represented? Actions are going to be represented again compactly by saying if let's say a state has 15 state variables, it may well be that an action only changes the value of the fourth state variable. So I would just represent this action by saying the guy who flips fourth state variable action. And all it does is it takes a state and it flips the value of the fourth state variable. That's it. It's much simpler to describe the action that way than the more extensional way, which is an action would be described by giving a big state-by-state matrix. For every state, if you do this action, what state would you get to? And that state-by-state matrix would be has as many rows and columns as the number of states in the world. So it's much simpler to represent actions by talking about the pieces that they change rather than in terms of all the states. Okay? So let's look at an example and then we'll come back. So basically the reason planning is different from search from this point of view is we look at these factored representations where the states have internal structure and then actions can, and we can use this internal structure to our advantage in driving the search. We'll see how the search can be improved now that we know more about the internals of the state. Okay? So we'll again talk about heuristics, etc., except now we have an extra piece of assumption we have made. So, a very simple world, and I'm just going to drive the point home today that basically you are talking about this world in terms of some state variables and the actions that only change those state variables. Okay? So these are a bunch of blocks on the table, and I'm trying to define a world where there are a bunch of blocks on the table in some configuration, and then my goal state might be that I want to go into a slightly different configuration. And for now, let's assume that these blocks have names, and the agent would know which block it's talking about. There's a huge issue as to how do you look at a block and figure out it's a block A, not block B. But we, you know, as we decided, we would talk about perception. Okay? So here is a scenario where in the initial state, I have two blocks, A, B. And A is on table, B is on table, A is clear, B is clear, and there is a hand which holds the blocks and it's empty. It can only hold one block at a time and it's empty. Okay, now the names here, by the way, the names here are just for your happiness. By calling this on table, I'm not making my program think about onness and tableness. Okay, all we really care about is, you can think of this as V1 of A, V1 of B, V2 of A, V2 of B, and so on. I'll just use names that make sense to you so that when you're writing the action description, you know, you would not make mistakes. Okay. Now, in this kind of a domain, in this particular problem, how many state variables are there in this particular problem? I have on table A is one variable, on table B is one variable, clear A is one variable, clear B is one variable, hand empty is another variable, on AB is one variable, on BA is another variable. All of these can be true and false. Okay? Those are all the variables. And I can define a state by giving the truth falsity values to each of the state variables. Okay? Now, the goal that I want to achieve is this. B should be not clear. B should not be clear, and hand should be empty. So I should go to a state where B is not clear and hand is empty. That's all I want. Okay? And the kind of actions I have are I can pick up, I can put down, I can stack, I can unstack. And I define these in terms of the algebraic cut and paste operations you can do to the states themselves directly. So normally the most obvious way to define an action is a state by state matrix. Where there are n states in the world. And for each state, if you do the action, you need to tell me which state would you get to. And if it's a deterministic domain, you can put a 1. So for example, if doing doing action A in S1 gets me to S77, I'll put a 1 here and put zeros everywhere else, for example. This way I can define any action. This will always work. This is first principles definition of action. In this way, every action has the same size. Every action is a matrix of size S by S. Whether it only changes one state variable or it changes huge number of things, it has the same size. Okay. Whereas the way I'm looking at the actions here is I would rather than write that, I'm writing indirectly, I'm defining the action in terms of what state variable values would it change? If you apply this action in a state, in what would be the new state variable values in the state that results after the action? Okay, so for example, this one is saying if you ever pick up X, then the state that happens after pick up X, holding X would be true. If it is false before, it'll still be true now. If it was true before, it will still be true now. So you're essentially saying a bunch of variables will have certain specified values as given in the effects of the action. And now what is this precondition? This precondition is telling you whether the action is even applicable in a state. If it's not applicable, then you don't talk about what will happen after doing the action. Okay? And so if it's applicable, if it has the following state variables in that following value. Okay? So I have pick up, I have put down, I have stack, and I have unstack. And you know, you can almost understand what these are doing. Pick up will just pick a block. And to be able to pick a block, it better be the case that the hand is empty, X is clear, and X is on table. Because you can only pick up blocks apparently from the table, according to this definition. And similarly, put down, you must be holding the block, and then you just put it down directly onto the table. And stack and unstack are equivalents of pick up and put down, except you're doing the operation when the other block is on a block already. So presumably, you have to be more careful if you are putting other block on top or you're removing a block from the top. Okay? So by the way, you can see there is a solution for this, right? Can you solve this? You guys did blocks, right, when you were kids? Can you do this? What? A on B. If you put A on B, then B won't be clear, and hand would be empty. That's a goal state. Now, remember something I told you long back, which is initial state is always complete in deterministic problems, and goal state is partial. And a partial goal state is somehow more interesting because that means it's true in many, many possible scenarios. And so if you have a partial goal state, that means you have more than one real state of the world could be your goal state. Now, here actually, I could have defined my goal in two different ways. On A, B, not clear B, hand empty. That's first way. The second way is not clear B, hand empty. Supposedly, the second way, I'm being nice to you because I only told you some of the things that you need to do, not everything. But sometimes, removing details makes your life much harder because you don't know how to do the search. You try to do the search, and it's the end of the class, I guess you're not thinking, or you start, you know, to heck with it. But if I give you partial descriptions of the goal, sometimes it's harder to do the search, even though it should be easier search problem, because there are more states potentially which have the following properties. You may not necessarily know what is the direction to go. Now, let me do the simplest idea for doing search with these kinds of representations, which is, suppose I started with this state, which corresponds to this state, right? On table A, on table B, clear A, clear B, hand empty. Okay? What I'm going to do is directly do search without having a separate children generator function. I can just look at the actions, look at the state, and generate the children myself. So I now have a search algorithm which is tailored to work with this kind of representations, and I'll call it a planning algorithm. And all it does is it can look at this state, it can look at an action which has preconditions and effects, and directly generate the children's state. Directly generate the children's state. So now the children generator is no longer a black box outside of the algorithm, it's actually part right now. Okay, so what do I do here? If I were to do pickup A here, what would I do? I would look at pickup A, and first of all I have to ask myself, is pickup A feasible to do here? To do pickup A, sorry, I wish I had this here, to do pickup A, hand empty, clear A, and on table A must be true in the state where I'm trying to do pickup A. Okay? Hand empty, clear A, on table A. They are true. So I get to do pickup A. If I don't, then I won't have a branch corresponding to pickup A. There is no child from that branch at all. So since it's possible, now I have a child. The question is, what is that child? The way I represent the child is giving the truth falsity values of all the variables in the new state. Okay? And so what would I do here? I'll say, go back to pickup A and see what does it say are its effects. It says, I don't really care about everybody else. After I'm done, holding A must be true. Not on table A must be true. Not hand empty must be true. Not clear X, not clear A must be true. That's what I care. Okay? So, I wrote those in red. I just copied them directly. And then, having decided that these variables must have these values, everybody else is copied over from this state directly. That's all. Now, in this case, it looks as if you did more operations than actually transferred the guys which didn't change. But if I had 10,000 blocks on the table, and all I did was to pick up A, you would have a huge number of variables here, none of which would have changed, so you just copy them over implicitly to the next state, and you would have only changed those four state variables, which is darn good. Instead of writing a 2 power 10,000 by 2 power 10,000 matrix and put ones and zeros in it, you are getting by implicitly, directly, by just, you know, doing algebra on this state representation to get a new state representation. Right? So now if I continue, so I did pickup A, I got this. If I do pickup B, I'll get this. Okay? And those are my two children. Now the question, of course, is I have to pick one of these children and expand it further. I need a heuristic. Which one should I expand? That's the same issue that we talked about for normal heuristics. So the question is, for problems which have this kind of internal structure, can we do something general that will always work for all problems which have state variable representation than just saying find a good heuristic? Okay. To some extent, what we'll do next class is talk about some general class of heuristics which would work very well if the problems have this kind of structure. Okay. Now, if I don't have a heuristic, I can still work with this problem, right? So I'll expand this, I'll expand this, I'll expand the children, I'll expand the children, until I find a node, a state which corresponds to the goal state. Now, how do I know if I have reached the goal state or not? In the past, again, that's another opaque program which would say yes, no, yes, no. But now, I, the search algorithm for these kinds of representations, can tell whether I am at the goal or not. Okay, because I can see the internals of the state, and I know that all I need is any state where clear B is false and hand empty is true. Okay, any state where clear B is false and hand empty is true. Here is clear B is true, hand empty is false. It's exactly the opposite. So this is not a goal state yet, and this is all, this one clear B is false, but hand empty is also false. Okay, and so I'm not yet near the goal state. But furthermore, I actually know, even if I think that each piece of this goal state description is equally hard to achieve. Let's say I think of this goal is each variable's value that I care about. So I have two variables whose values I care about. Okay? Imagine that I just take this naive idea that every variable whose value I care about is going to be one of my goals. It's an independent goal. Okay? So then I could say, in this case, that neither of the variables have the values I want in this state, whereas at least one of the variables has the value that I want in this state. So here is a naive heuristic. It looks like this is closer to where I need to go. So I'll try to expand this further. The point is, you couldn't have done this if you did not know what's inside the state. But now that you know what's inside the state, this is only a naive heuristic. It turns out that, so for example, my two state variables were be a millionaire, true, false, have black socks, true, false. Those are the two goals I have. Okay? And it's not the case that I have one state where I have black socks, but I don't have $1 million. Another state, I have $1 million, I don't have black socks. It's not the case that both of those states are equally far from my goal, unless you really wear costly black socks. Okay? In most cases, if you have $1 million, you probably also have extra couple of bucks, and then you buy the black socks and you're done. Okay? So if you just count the goals that are different, it's not going to be telling you how far you are from the goal state. Much of what we'll do when we come back next class is, how do we compute these distances in terms of these individual goals being, getting all these individual goals to the right direction. And one other thing that we will do, which we can do because we now have the internal structure of the problem, is, believe it or not, this is the obvious thing. Start from the initial state, go forward. And we'll come back and say, I could start from the goal state and go backward. And I can define what that means directly and just do that. What? And you can do something in between too. And I can actually say, finally, what I'm looking for is the sequence of actions that I need to take from the initial state to the goal state. So since what I want is a sequence of actions, forget about states. Let me search in the space of sequence of actions. My original plan is empty thing, just do nothing. Then I start throwing in actions into this sequence. In the 14th step, do this action. In the 17th step, do this action. That would be sort of something in between. I'm no longer going from initial to goal state, nor from goal to initial state. I'm just making my plan by adding more and more actions. So I'm sort of constructing the search path by putting pieces of the path. Again, something that you can do because you know the internal structure. Okay? We'll look at some of these variations next. Thanks.